From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! As the battle for the Latin American seat on the U.N. Security Council continues, we'll speak with Venezuela's top man at the U.N., Ambassador Francisco Arias Cardenas, and the man some have called a saint of the modern American left, longtime conscientious objector, attorney, peace activist Staunton Lynn.
Those of us who think that soldiers should be able to say no to what's going on in Iraq need to deal with the fact that this is a volunteer military. Not too many Quakers and Mennonites in it. So what do soldiers do?
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Amidst rising levels of violence and service member deaths, the U.S. military has admitted its plan to control Baghdad has failed. On Thursday, the Pentagon said violence in the capital has increased by 22% in just the last 3 weeks. This month's U.S. death toll has reached 73. In what the New York Times calls one of the most somber assessments of the war by American commanders, Major General William Caldwell called the current situation, quote, disheartening, and said the U.S. will rethink its strategy.
I think we're getting far beyond my realm to start making analogies back to Vietnam War. But I would tell you that we're obviously very concerned about what we're seeing in the city. We're taking a lot of time to go back and look at the whole Baghdad security plan.
Despite the announcement, the U.S. military will go back to the drawing board, the New York Times reports. Senior American military officials who've discussed the Baghdad operation say they have no fundamental reworking of the plan in mind. Meanwhile, The Washington Post is reporting the Iraqi government has ordered its health ministry to stop disclosing figures on civilian deaths. A confidential memo from the top U.N. official in Iraq says the order threatens to disrupt international efforts to gain an accurate measure of the scale of violence in Iraq. The move comes on the heels of a new study last week that said an estimated 650,000 people have died since the U.S.-led invasion 3 years ago. In an update on a story we've been following, a federal judge has rejected the bid of an American citizen facing the death penalty in Iraq to prevent the U.S. military from handing him over to Iraqi forces. Mohammed Munaf was sentenced to death last week on charges of kidnapping of three Romanian journalists. Munaf was unable to hear or challenge the evidence against him. His lawyers say the judge had been prepared to dismiss the case until two U.S. military officials intervened and told the judge to hand him the death penalty. On Thursday, U.S. District Judge Royce Lamberth said he had no authority to intervene in the case because Munaf is currently being held by coalition forces and not just the U.S. military. It's widely believed Munaf is being held in a U.S.-run prison. You can go to our website, democracynow.org, for our interview with Mohammed Munaf's attorney on Tuesday's broadcast. Meanwhile, pressure is growing on the Iraqi government from all sides. On Wednesday, Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki made the rare move of meeting with Shiite spiritual leader Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani and leading anti-U.S. Shiite cleric Maqdar al-Sadr. Speaking to reporters, Sadr indicated he'd be open to dropping his opposition to a recent law that would allow the formation of autonomous regions in Iraq.
It is up to the Iraqi people to decide on federalism or any other issue. And if the people want federalism, it is okay. And if it is not, it is their legitimate right.
In other news, the State Department says it's told the Israeli government the U.S. is concerned over new visa restrictions that are preventing Palestinian Americans from visiting the occupied territories. Scores of Palestinian American academics and business figures have complained Israel is stopping them from traveling to the West Bank and Gaza. In a letter this week to academic and civil society members worldwide, the presidents of Palestinian universities write, quote, "We call on you to support appropriate collective action against this dangerous policy that threatens to empty the occupied Palestinian territory of its educated classes." In Iran, President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad has renewed calls for unconditional negotiations to resolve the standoff over his country's nuclear activities.
Our nation does not want one iota more than its right. Our nation is in favor of talks and negotiations. but the world should know that the Iranian nation will not retreat one iota from its right.
The UN's top official for the Middle East peace process has criticized Israel for its ongoing siege of the Gaza Strip. The official, Alvaro de Soto, addressed the UN Security Council on Thursday.
The combination of near-total closure of the Gaza Strip, non-payment of public sector salaries, absence of basic law and order, declining service delivery, continued military strikes by air and land, and the lack of any apparent political horizon is a truly explosive one, as potentially dangerous for Israel as it is currently dangerous for Palestinians. As my colleague Jan Egeland puts it, Gaza is a ticking time bomb, and only a political way out can defuse it.
In other news, Hezbollah is being accused of using cluster munitions during Israel's recent invasion of Lebanon. Human Rights Watch says Hezbollah's cluster strikes caused at least one death and 12 injuries in Israeli towns. Israel's already been accused of dropping more than 1 million cluster bombs on Lebanon, most within the final days of its invasion. This is Human Rights Watch Executive Director Stephen Coos.
We think that both Israel and Hezbollah likely violated international humanitarian law with their use of cluster munitions. In fact, on both sides, it appears that there was deliberate targeting of civilian areas. That's a violation whether you're using a cluster munition or not. But the danger to civilians is enhanced when you use a cluster munition because of the long-term dangers of the duds and because of the wide area effect.
Stephen Goose of Human Rights Watch. In Mexico, the Senate voted Thursday to reject the dismissal of Oaxaca's state government. The demand has been at the heart of an ongoing teacher strike in Oaxaca that has also called for better conditions and increased wages. The teachers want the government to fire State Governor Ulises Ruiz. The Senate vote comes one day after another teacher was killed in the latest attack on Oaxaca's protesters. The teacher, Fernando Hernandez, is at least the eighth person killed in the standoff with the state government. And here in the United States, the Bush administration has indicated it may ignore a congressional request to include the cost of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan in next year's budget for defense spending. According to Defense News, that's one of two dozen provisions President Bush says he might not abide by in a signing statement attached to this week's Defense Authorization Act. Funding for the wars have come through emergency supplementals or bridge funding that critics say are more difficult to scrutinize. The latest defense budget signing statement is one of a record number issued during the president's administration. Bush also signed off on the possibility of ignoring requirements to provide a response plan for dealing with unexploded munitions and studying the accuracy of current methods to assess the safety of the U.S. nuclear stockpile. In other news from Washington, a federal judge has ordered the Bush administration to release records on who has visited Vice President Dick Cheney. The Washington Post took the request to court after being denied by the Secret Service earlier this year. The Bush administration has argued releasing the records would compromise Cheney's ability to do his job. The court ruling comes 1 month after a similar lawsuit led to the release of records showing two key figures in the Jack Abramoff lobbying scandal held more than 100 meetings inside the Bush White House. In California, the election campaign of a Republican congressional candidate is being cited as the possible source of a letter aimed at discouraging Latinos to vote. State investigators say they're looking into whether supporters of Orange County Republican Tan Nguyen are behind a message that falsely claims it's a crime for immigrants to vote. The letter's written in Spanish and warns immigrants of jail or deportation if they vote next month. Nguyen has run on an openly anti-immigration platform. Investigators say they've tracked down where the letters were printed and how they were financed, but did not provide further details. In environmental news, the U.S. space agency, NASA, says it's recorded the largest hole in the ozone over Antarctica on record. Government scientists say the size of the hole now exceeds the size of North America. The development comes as the U.N.'s top environmental official has issued a new plea for increased efforts to curb global warming. The official executive director of the U.N. Environment Program, Achim Steiner, spoke Thursday in Beijing.
We'll have disease spreading. We will have implications in terms of global trade, perhaps. Nations that don't play their part in terms of a climate regime, how do they work with nations who are investing in offsetting their CO2 emissions? So the potential for conflict to arise from the consequences of global warming are major trends that we now see.
Achim Steiner's comments ahead of next month's summit meeting of environmental ministers in the Kenyan capital of Nairobi. In Virginia, up to 2,000 people held a demonstration Thursday at a fundraiser for Republican Senator George Allen, attended by President Bush. Democracy Now! Reached Dana Baliki of Code Pink, who took part in the protest. And finally, Congressional Quarterly is reporting embattled Republican Congressmember Jerry Lewis of California has fired 60 investigators who took part in probes of government fraud and corruption. Lewis is chair of House Appropriations, one of the most powerful committees in Congress. He's been under investigation for his ties to a lobbyist linked to jailed former Congressmember Randy Duke Cunningham and for how he helped oversee an annual $900 billion in congressional spending. A former FBI agent says Lewis's firing have stalled dozens of ongoing investigations of waste and abuse. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On Thursday, the Bush administration urged Venezuela to give up its campaign to win a seat on the United Nations Security Council. Over the past 4 days, the UN General Assembly has conducted 30 rounds of votes to decide whether Venezuela or Guatemala should represent Latin America on the Security Council. Guatemala's won every round of voting, but has failed to secure the needed two-thirds majority. Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez has said he would use the seat to be the voice of the South and to challenge American hegemony. Prior to the voting, President Chavez accused the White House of waging a dirty war against his candidacy.
No va a ser fácil, yo lo he dicho.
I have said that it is not going to be easy because the empire is moving all of its pieces and pressuring and trying to blackmail half the world to try to impede us from becoming a non-permanent member of the Security Council.
On Thursday, John Bolton, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, urged Venezuela to drop out of the race.
Up by about 30 votes consistently. They're very close to a two-thirds majority. And the honorable thing here would be for the candidate that's now lost 28 out of 29 votes to withdraw. But if Venezuela insists on putting everybody through all this, vote after vote after vote, we'll be here and we'll continue to support Guatemala.
Voting is expected to resume, but Guatemala called for a longer extension. This is Guatemala's foreign minister, Gert Rosenthal.
No sepa muy pocos antecedentes de que eso ocurra. We would like there to be a longer recess, so that we can talk among each other, among ourselves and between ourselves to see if we find a way out. We are not happy with tying up the work of the General Assembly, but for the time being, since we are in the lead, we have no intention of stepping down.
That was Guatemala's ambassador. Ambassador Francisco Arias Cardenas is Venezuelan's ambassador to the UN. He joins us now in our Firehouse studios. Luisa Golondano will help with translation. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Gracias. Muchísimas gracias. Buenos días.
Thank you.
Can John Bolton, the UN, U.S. ambassador to the UN, says Venezuela should withdraw the nomination to be have the Latin American seat on the UN Security Council. What is your response?
No, copié bien.
Que dice John Bolton que Venezuela debe retirar su candidatura. Sí. ¿Cuál es su opinión al respecto?
Mira, el señor John Bolton no puede ser quien imponga las reglas dentro de la elección de la Asamblea General. Es la Asamblea General la que debe decidir y allí sí.
Ambassador Bolton is not the person that has to decide on this issue. The General Assembly is the proper body to make any decision with this regard.
What is happening this week? How are you waging your campaign to take the seat on the UN Security Council.
¿Qué ha pasado durante esta semana? ¿Cómo ha usted ideado su campaña en este sentido?
Nosotros estamos tocando en la campaña asuntos que son trascendentes y de fondo, no solamente el asunto de votos para colocar un país en el Consejo de Seguridad, sino procesos más profundos y trascendentes.
What we are doing are the special point in our campaign. We are trying to go far beyond the simple fact of just winning a seat. We are trying to more transcendent issues.
El tema esencial para nosotros es impedir el veto del señor Bolton y del señor Bush, aliado con otros países poderosos, para que un país pueda optar al Consejo de Seguridad. Eso sería tanto avalarlo, sería darles el veto previo, además del que ya tienen al interior del Consejo
de
Seguridad.
What we're trying to do is just trying to avoid the previous veto of Ambassador Bolton for a legitimate right of a member state to be elected as a member, as a non-permanent member on the Security Council.
Nosotros hemos evidenciado que las presiones, los chantajes, las llamadas, fundamentalmente del gobierno del señor Bush y del señor Bolton como ejecutor, pero de los países amigos de ellos, no han permitido que sea una elección normal, sino que la han polarizado.
Basically, blackmail or any other pressure, it won't have any effect. What he was have seen in this on this campaign is that Ambassador Bolton and his allies have been trying to avoid the election of a sovereign state.
You have accused John Bolton, the United States, of interfering with the selection process. What has the U.S. done?
Han tenido muchas maneras para intervenir. Primero, las declaraciones públicas rechazando la posibilidad de que Venezuela esté y teniendo todo el poder que tienen, apoyar un candidato y rechazarnos y atacarnos y descalificarnos.
They have indeed several attempts. They have made several attempts to oppose the Venezuelan candidature to the Security Council, certainly.
What?
Declaraciones públicas desde Condoleezza Rice hasta los funcionarios medios y bajos del Departamento de Estado atacando a Venezuela, por una parte. Por otra parte, las llamadas, las presiones, los chantajes de los que tenemos evidencia, que directamente se han hecho a países pequeños para que no apoyen a Venezuela y voten por el otro candidato.
We indeed have faced several threats and several pressures. From several officers from the United States government, as Condoleezza Rice, who have put a lot of pressure, especially in small countries.
What kind of pressure?
Todo tipo de presiones. Uno fundamental tiene que ver con llamadas. La presencia misma y el despliegue de los que está en las fotografías y está en las tomas de video de la delegación norteamericana desplegada en la sala haciendo campaña para el otro país del GRULAC que compite con nosotros y llamadas directas que nos han dicho algunos amigos pequeños que no debemos delatar porque son débiles para decirles desde la Casa Blanca que deben votar por el otro país y no por Venezuela.
We have seen several displays on their campaign. Basically, they remain at the plenary hall, calling people, making phone calls, and visiting several countries and putting a lot of pressure in small countries. And they have asked for to keep the secret, because they are weak countries.
President Chavez in Venezuela accused Washington of waging a dirty war in this last-ditch effort to make Guatemala, not Venezuela, give it the seat on the Security Council. He said the delegates of the U.S. are running around the halls of the United Nations headquarters. If you try to talk to an ambassador, as soon as he is done, five U.S. representatives immediately surround him or her. Is this the case?
Que ellos han estado, han dicho que andan por toda la sala,
sí,
haciendo campaña.
Eso ha ocurrido, el despliegue por la sala, las presiones directas, pero hemos logrado algo que es muy importante. Hemos logrado en estas dos semanas, primero, ayudar a que pierdan el miedo los muchos países que han sido presionados. Eso es un logro importante para nosotros. Segundo, hemos logrado contener y desenmascarar ese abuso del poder y de la fuerza, que significa vetar un país no con un derecho, sino con la presión y la fuerza para que pueda ser electo al Consejo de Seguridad. Por eso el tema nuestro es un tema de fondo, no es un tema solamente de una elección entre dos países del GRULAC, es un tema de fondo, es traer la democracia al interior de las Naciones Unidas.
We have unmasked their attempts to put pressure over several countries. But this election, our feeling is, we are convinced that this election goes far beyond the contest between two countries.
What goes beyond? Why is this more important than these two countries?
Porque es más importante que la sola elección entre dos países.
Es más importante porque se está en un proceso de reformas de Naciones Unidas. Y si en ese proceso de reformas nosotros admitiéramos que en vez de ir hacia adelante en la democratización, retrocedemos y admitimos el que la fuerza que se esconde y que navega por debajo, que no se ve aparente, y la presión de los fuertes se impusiera sobre los débiles con el silencio, nosotros estaríamos siendo cómplices de la ineficiencia de las Naciones Unidas.
If we accept the pressure and if we accept what they're trying to do, he said that it's far beyond the election between two countries because it has to do with the reform of the United Nations, which is an important issue. If we accept their pressure, we will be it will go against the democratization, which is quite necessary within the United Nations.
Para hacer las reformas al interior del Consejo de Seguridad se necesitan países independientes. Nosotros creemos, estamos seguros de que Venezuela como voz independiente va a contribuir a las reformas. Eso es lo que se está discutiendo en este momento, la posibilidad de que un país independiente pueda llegar y que no pueda ser vetado previamente. Hasta ahora hemos logrado aguantar la embestida. Creemos que en las próximas semanas vamos a remontar la cuesta y vamos a lograr derrotar esta política de Bolton y de Bush.
Up to now, we have resisted all the pressure, and we think that it is quite necessary that an independent country with an independent voice will contribute to achieve the necessary reform of the Security Council.
The Associated Press is reporting as Venezuela lobbies for a UN Security Council seat. President Chavez has bolstered his chances by spreading petrodollars across the Americas and beyond, extending an airstrip on a Caribbean island, sending emergency food aid to Africa, fixing a rundown hospital in Uruguay.
Nosotros tenemos una política de colaboración sur-sur que no tiene que ver con la campaña del Consejo de Seguridad. Nosotros, el presidente Chávez ha dicho que Venezuela, para ayudarse con los países hermanos, debe compartir el pan. Y eso lo venimos haciendo desde hace 8 años. Eso no son relaciones ni contribuciones para la campaña del Consejo de Seguridad.
Before the campaign for winning a seat in the Security Council, one of the main policies in our country had been South-South cooperation. And President Chavez several times has insisted that we have to share the bread, we have to cooperate with our South-South countries.
En este momento, nosotros estamos frente a las presiones que hace el gobierno de Bush a través de Bolton y de sus aliados, trabajando a la conciencia de los pueblos y diciéndoles que nos acompañen para frenar las imposiciones. Ese es el tema fundamental que estamos llevando y no es el dinero ni los petrodólares.
Our campaign is basically based in cooperation, as he said, and is based on trying to convince the people that we are an independent voice and independent option. We are not by any means using petrodollars in this campaign.
I wanted to ask you about the international reaction to President Chavez's comments in front of the UN General Assembly last month when he called President Bush the devil and said he still smelled the sulfur burning as he stood there speaking. Well, I sat down with Bolivian President Evo Morales the day after the speech and asked President Morales of Bolivia what he felt about Chavez's comments.
I'm not interested in commenting about these words between two presidents.
Pero estoy convencido. Personas que representan una familia.
But I'm convinced that people who represent a family.
Sean presidentes, no presidentes. Sean profesionales, no profesionales.
They can be professionals or not. They can be presidents or not.
Tienen dignidad.
They all have dignity.
Una cosa es cuestiones políticas.
One thing is to question someone's policies.
No, podemos tener diferencias.
We can have differences.
Pero dañar la imagen o una ofensa personal no tanto comparto.
Well, to attack someone's image or a direct offense, I don't think I share that.
What is that is President Morales of Bolivia. Sí. Ambassador, your response.
Realmente la metáfora, la imagen que usó el presidente Chávez es fuerte y podría alguien pensar que se trata de una ofensa. En realidad no es una ofensa, sino es un manejo del lenguaje adecuado.
What President Chávez did, he just used a strong metaphor, but it could be misinterpreted. But it's not that it wasn't the sense he didn't mean to be offensive.
Fundamentalmente se trataba de desmontar con una frase muy fuerte un discurso mentiroso, un discurso engañoso del día anterior. Bush se quería presentar como un angelito y como Dios, dándole consejos a Irak mientras hay casi 1 millón de muertos por su invasión, y dándole consejos al Líbano mientras había avalado la masacre que hizo el ejército de Israel, vetando la resolución de Francia. Chávez lo desenmascaró muy fuertemente. Algunos se quedaron en la frase inicial, pero había que ir al fondo del discurso.
What President Chávez did was just unmask his statement. President Bush came to the general debate with the discourse trying to be like God, and he was advising Iraq and Iran and several countries. Since what they have done at the Security Council was just obstruct the resolutions on the invasion to Lebanon and veto and other resolutions.
Venezuela is appearing as a potential hub of terrorism in America in the eyes of U.S. officials, according to a congressional report that was released on Thursday. The report says, according to senior U.S. military and intelligence officials, Venezuela is emerging as a potential hub of terrorism in the Western Hemisphere, providing assistance to Islamic radicals from the Middle East and other terrorists. It says Venezuela has issued thousands of social security cards to people from Cuba, Colombia, and Middle Eastern nations that host foreign terrorist organizations, according to the congressional report and Texas Congressmember Michael McCaul. Your response.
No es posible que se utilice el terrorismo y los señalamientos de terrorismo para acusar a cualquier gobierno que es incómodo o que no se somete a las imposiciones de los Estados Unidos. Esto es una utilización política que no tiene ningún basamento y sale de los mismos que quieren destruir la experiencia política que vive Venezuela.
This is basically an intention to discredit the political process that Venezuela is currently facing. It's not proper to associate our process with any terrorist event or any terrorist harboring any terrorism.
If you did get the seat on the UN Security Council, what would you do? Why is this important to you?
Para nosotros tiene muchísima importancia esta campaña. La primera es mostrar a todos los países que podemos soportar las presiones, que podemos aguantarlas y que podemos levantarnos todos juntos, los países pobres que somos mayoría, con dignidad.
For us, it's very important. We're going to demonstrate that we can face and resist all the whatever pressure, all the pressure.
Pero la segunda es la que vamos a emprender en los próximos días, demostrar que podemos levantarnos de las presiones y podemos ir haciendo elecciones libres dentro de la Asamblea General, que es la que vamos a hacer para tratar de tener miembros independientes dentro del Consejo de Seguridad que impidan que las presiones de los grandes sean las que incidan en las decisiones. Esto lo estamos haciendo por primera vez. Antes, cuando se dio una confrontación parecida entre Cuba y Colombia, estaban detrás el imperio ruso y el imperio americano. Ahora lo estamos haciendo solo con la dignidad de los pueblos del sur.
We are facing this election based on the dignity of the countries of the South. In previous election, we have witnessed that the empires of the United States and Russia has been in back of the election, but have been behind the elections and behind the efforts of the countries to be an independent voice.
Finally, as we look at the relationship between the United States and Venezuela, yesterday we had a reporter on our broadcast who wrote a book called Ghost Plane about the CIA flights taking prisoners to different secret prisons. And one thing he mentioned was that there was evidence of these CIA planes that landed in Venezuela about a month before the attempted coup against Chavez in April of 2002. Do you have any knowledge of this?
Ella habla sobre la
vuelo secreto
de la CIA antes del golpe de Estado en Venezuela.
La participación de algunos sectores del gobierno de los Estados Unidos no debió darse. A mí me parece que fue un error muy grave que cometió la administración de Bush. Obnubilados tal vez, engañados por sectores internos que les dijeron que tenían suficiente poder para derribar a Chávez. Creo que fue una muy mala experiencia, pero nosotros no vemos detrás de esto el pueblo de los Estados Unidos, sino fundamentalmente los errores de un sector de halcones, de un sector militarista, del propio gobierno de Bush.
We consider that by any means the United States was not allowed to intervene in the COP. And we consider also that it was they acted according to the information given by the opposition forces in our country.
Are you saying that you have information that the U.S. was involved?
Hay muchísimas informaciones que ha manejado el propio gobierno. Hay cantidad, no solo sobre vuelos, sino relaciones directas. Yo pienso que con el tiempo van a ir saliendo a la luz pública. Y actuaron obnubilados, con los ojos cerrados y engañados por los militares y los políticos que estaban envueltos contra Chávez.
We have several information, but I think that it will be arising in the next future. But he said that basically the United States acted cheated by the military opposes forces and the opposition parties in Venezuela. Mm-hmm.
So there is now a timeout between you and Guatemala until next week after these 35 rounds of voting?
Se ha paralizado por unos días la votación. Tenemos 5 días para trabajar. Nosotros vamos a trabajar muy duro. Estamos llamando, reuniéndonos con los embajadores, explicándoles cuál es el fondo de la elección que se está haciendo. Y creemos que vamos a aprovechar esto para remontar, porque ya los países han perdido el miedo a las presiones.
We have 5 days for our campaign, so we're gonna take advantage of it to make bilateral to have bilateral meeting with countries and to explain to them our real purposes. I think that we are gonna certainly take advantage of this.
And you'll begin again next week in the rounds of voting.
Seguiremos el próximo miércoles y trabajaremos en la mañana. Habrá elecciones en la mañana y el trabajo de la Asamblea General el resto del tiempo. 2 mañanas por semana vamos a seguir trabajando.
We're going to resume on Wednesday, and there will be 2 elections in the morning, and the rest of the week they will develop the ordinary work of the General Assembly.
I want to thank you very much for being with us, Francisco Arias Cardenas, Venezuela's ambassador to the United Nations. Luis Golondano, thank you for translating. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We'll be back in a minute.
A quien nos ayude a encontrar la salida, y aquella palabra de fuerza y de fe que me has dado me da la certeza que siempre estuviste a mi lado. Tú eres mi amigo del alma en toda jornada, sonrisa y abrazo festivo a cada llegada. Dices verdades tan grandes con frases abiertas. Tú eres realmente más cierto de horas inciertas.
Roberto Carlos, amigo, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 500 stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR stations, on public access TV and PBS stations, on low-power FM, college and community radio stations, and on both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375. And we are broadcasting, podcasting online at democracynow.org. Our headlines are also in Spanish, and audio and transcript form, and you can access them at our website as well. I'm Amy Goodman. Our next guest has been called a saint of the modern American left. For the past 50 years, Staunton Lynn has dedicated his life to activism and social change as a historian, lawyer, labor activist, Quaker pacifist. In the early 1960s, he taught history at Spelman College in Georgia alongside Howard Zinn. One of his star students was Alice Walker. He helped direct the Mississippi Freedom Schools. In April 1965, he spoke at the first March on Washington against the Vietnam War and became an early leader of the anti-war movement. Later that year, he traveled to Hanoi with Tom Hayden on a fact-finding mission in defiance of U.S. law. At the time, he was a professor at Yale University, but he was denied tenure because of the trip. In the 1970s, Staunton Lynn went to law school, then spent years focusing on labor and prison issues. In 2004, he wrote the definitive history of the 1993 Ohio prison uprising at Lucasville, the country's bloodiest prison riot since Attica. Last year, he sued the Pentagon over its stop-loss program that's been used to involuntarily extend the terms of enlistment for soldiers in Iraq. On Thursday night here in New York, Lynn gave the first annual Dave Dellinger Lecture on Nonviolence, sponsored by the War Resisters League. The speech was called Resistance to War in a Volunteer Army. Staunton Lynn joins us now in our studios at Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! What do you mean, resistance to war in a volunteer army?
Well, the
concept of conscientious objection in American law and in the regulations of all the military services is that you must fulfill two requirements. You must be opposed to war in any form, that is, to all wars, and you must do so on the basis of religious training and belief. But a moment's thought will suggest that there are not going to be too many objectors to all wars in a volunteer army. So what does Camille Mejia or what does Kevin Benderman do if they are in Iraq and they see around them what they can only consider war crimes? How are they to find a way to resist? And my point is that there is available to such persons our own Nuremberg precedent. We hanged German and Japanese leaders because they engaged in war crimes in a particular war. We said that orders from a superior are no excuse. Well, the logic of those precedents is that a soldier in Iraq, or like Lieutenant Aaron Watada, under orders to be deployed to Iraq, can say, I consider this to be a war crime. Even if my superiors tell me something different, I am obliged to use my own judgment, my own conscience, and so I say no. So my plea is that we recognize the legitimacy of objection to a particular war on the basis of a good faith belief that war crimes are being committed.
Can you talk about the lawsuit that you brought over stop loss and explain exactly what it means and who you represented?
Well, in that particular lawsuit, there were a number of persons in the military who had signed up for what they understood to be a definite length of time. And our lead plaintiff was a man named Qualls, who had gone in under a program entitled Try One. And Try One said, well, try it out for a year, see how you like it, and then you can decide. And so he went in, and as the year drew to a close, they said, oh, no, you can't leave. We're going to extend your service. And this was the concept of stop loss, that no matter what the condition of the contract, the contract terms under which a particular service person had voluntarily enlisted, entered into this contract with our government, tough. If we, the United States authorities, decide that you're going to serve longer, that's all there is to it. So that was the theory of that lawsuit.
And what happened?
Well, the same judge that I heard washed his hands of the fate of this gentleman in Iraq.
Munaf, who is facing the death penalty.
Exactly. That same judge told us, well, didn't you read the small print on the backside of the page? Didn't you understand the general context that anyone in the military is obligated to do whatever he or she is ordered to do? And so he dismissed the claim. But I think, like so many similar efforts, it served the purpose of publicizing the dilemma of a lot of folks, especially guardsmen, reserve people who are torn out of their family situations for a distinct period of time and then told that that's going to become indefinite.
What is your assessment of the situation in Iraq right now?
Well, I think it's Vietnam in spades. That is to say, illegitimate and corrupt as every South Vietnamese government was, I don't think they hold a candle to what we've created in Iraq, where before the government of Iraq can blow its nose, it has to seek permission from the United States military. And I think that it's clear, I'm not saying anything new, that the majority of Iraqis, the great majority of Iraqis, and the majority of United States servicemen at the moment feel the same thing. Whatever problems might arise from the withdrawal of United States troops, whatever conflicts there may be within Iraq, they are more manageable than the conflicts that we create by our presence. So we should leave immediately.
And what was your reaction to President Bush in talking to ABC News, comparing Iraq to Vietnam, to the Tet Offensive?
Well, isn't it interesting that they've finally come around to that after saying that it wasn't an insurgency, it wasn't a civil war? Now they have finally conceded that they were wrong when they forever denied the parallel to Vietnam. It's the same thing. Anyone who passed through those experiences of the 60s has to be mortified, just covered with shame and distress by the inability of the people who run this country to learn anything from their experience.
When did you apply for conscientious objector status?
I suppose it would have been 1952, and the particular status I applied for was to be an unarmed medic within the military. I didn't fancy myself planting pine trees while someone else my age, who didn't know about the possibility of conscientious objection, was getting his behind shot off. So I chose an option where I wouldn't have to carry a gun or shoot anyone, where the rate of casualties was as high or higher as among infantrymen. And there was a way to do that within selective service law at that time, and that's what I did.
What did you do?
Well, I just completed basic training as a medic, and then I was thrown out. What happened was that Senator McCarthy, that's not Eugene, that's Joe, discovered, I believe, a major at Fort Dix, whom he claimed was a member of the United States Communist Party. And the Army panicked. And so they reached out to several dozen of us, I think between 75 and 100. And on the basis of information, all of which they had at the time of our induction, they gave us undesirable discharges. One of the allegations against myself was, it is said that your mother is a hypermodern educator. And one of our group took it to the United States Supreme Court, and the Army told the Supreme Court, yeah, it was wrong, but there's nothing you can do about it, which is always a bad thing to say to a judge. And so the next thing I knew, we all had honorable discharges. I had GI Bill. I was able to become a historian.
You lost tenureship at Yale.
Yes.
Explain what happened.
Well, the system then, and I think the system now, is to hire more junior professors than they intend ultimately to promote, and to set these folks in competition one with another. But informally, it was said to me that I was a golden boy. I didn't have to worry. They wouldn't have invited me unless they expected me to have tenure. Then I went to Hanoi. Then I was told, Staunton, there's a financial problem. We're not going to be able to create any more tenured professors during a period which, yeah, you're right, is just a year longer than the period in which you have to make tenure. So I waited. I asked them 6 months later, is that still the case? They said yes. I looked for a job elsewhere. I moved to Chicago, and soon after I moved, the financial problem disappeared.
What did you do when you went to Hanoi with Tom Hayden?
Well, we didn't speak French. So as in your conversation with the Venezuelan ambassador, we had to speak through an interpreter. But there are two conversations that stand out in my memory. And one was in Moscow before we got there. We spoke with a very elderly gentleman, a very frail man, who was the representative in the Soviet Union of the National Liberation Front of South Vietnam. And he somehow perceived through the translation that my attitude was that the mighty United States could blow these little brown people to bits. And he looked at me and he said, "No, Professor, you're wrong. We're going to win." He said that in December 1965. He said, "With every American soldier that lands in my country, one more person will come to the National Liberation Front." And if I have a moment more, let me describe a second conversation. When we were in Hanoi, we went to a factory. And I was quite excited because there were photographs of a demonstration in Berkeley that I had been part of. And then we went to a little room adjacent to the factory floor to meet with the manager of the factory. It was a table with a white tablecloth and little dishes of hard candies. And I figured this was the 6,000th welcoming speech. So I kind of fiddled with the candy and didn't pay too much attention. And I heard the manager say, "You know, we are a great admirer of your country, of your Declaration of Independence written by Abraham Lincoln." And I had a momentary thought, what a jerk. And then I thought, no, he knows more about my country than I do about his. And he went on to say, "But just now, we find the word American difficult to say." And there was this pause, and I'm fiddling with the candy. And finally, I look up, and he's weeping. And that's when my notions about inscrutable Orientals went out the window.
We're talking to Staaten Lin, legendary peace activist, longtime social justice advocate, helped direct the Mississippi Freedom Schools, went to Hanoi with Tom Hayden, lost his, tenure at Yale, and wrote the definitive history of the 1993 Ohio prison uprising in Lucasville. Can you summarize that for people?
Well, there were three big prison rebellions between 1970 and 1995. Attica, 1971, Santa Fe, tragic situation where prisoners slaughtered one another, and then finally in 1993, Lucasville, Ohio. It lasted 11 days, nine prisoners and a hostage officer were killed. A surrender was negotiated, and no sooner was the surrender negotiated with various prisoner spokespersons than the state of Ohio turned around and began to build death penalty cases against those very leaders and spokespersons. They didn't care who had really done things. They wanted to nail the leaders so that no prisoner would ever have this idea again. And we're still deep in the process of resisting those executions. Three of the five leaders who were sentenced to death are now in federal court. The person closest to execution is a man named Sadiq Abdullah Hassan, who was the imam, the prayer leader of the Muslim prisoners. I've just filed a friend of the court brief for the ACLU pointing out that 14 prisoners have stated under oath that it was not Hassan who was responsible for the death of the officer. And, you know, you hope and pray that if there can be, as with Mumia, if there can be enough concern outside the courtroom, sooner or later the folks inside will get the message.
Wasn't this an unusual situation where you had different sectors of the prison together?
It was, and I'll never forget the moment when my wife, who was reading transcripts, came running to me and she said, "Start and read this. And it was the testimony of the chief investigator for the state, a man named Sergeant Hudson. And the question was, well, what did you find when you went into the occupied cell block after the surrender? And he said, well, there were all kinds of graffiti on the walls and in the gymnasium. Well, what did the graffiti say? The graffiti said, black and white together. Convict unity, and my favorite, convict race. Some people may think we're black and white. No, no, we're all convicts. We are a convict race. And I was very moved. I hadn't seen anything quite like that since the South, 30 years before. And the extraordinary thing is that those five men, the five men sentenced to death, three black, two white, one of the whites, a leader of the Aryan Brotherhood, have maintained their solidarity just like this for the last 13 years.
Staunton Lynn, as we wrap up this conversation, what gives you hope today?
Well, it's funny. I suppose as you get older, people ask you that question. Why are you still plugging away? I guess what gives me hope is the kind of thing that I've just described, or what we see going on in Latin America today, of which your earlier guest was a spokesperson. I mean, can you imagine people taking factories over in Argentina, a woman who used to be a house servant becoming the Minister of Justice in Bolivia, the teachers in Oaxaca going on strike and demanding shoes for their children? I mean, how can you not have hope when things like this are happening in the world?
And the way you'd compare the peace movement in Vietnam with the peace movement today?
Well, one of the important differences is that the labor movement reacted much more quickly this time around. And it was a mystery to me. There was a Teamsters local in Chicago who voted unanimously to condemn the war in Iraq. And they convened the first meeting of labor against the war, not too long after the war began.
We have 10 seconds.
And it was the Vietnam vets in the local who did it.
So you think it's the Iraq vets today?
I beg your pardon?
You're saying it was the vets.
The vets from Vietnam told people they'd seen this movie already.
Staunton Lynn, I want to thank you very much for being with us, joining us on Democracy Now! Today. Well, we are out of time. Tonight I'll be in San Antonio at the Esperanza Center in Texas, tomorrow in San Rafael in California, and on Sunday in Phoenix, Arizona. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Shufa Bukadush, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Frank Lopez, Aaron Mate, Jen Utes, Mike DeFilippo, and Nick Marsilio are our engineers. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.